The Danger of the Political Fashion Flip and a Loss of Perspective. I'm Justin Katz, and this is Last Impressions 25. So first things first, send up the flags, shoot off the fireworks. We are going to have a statewide budget. They've come to an agreement. They've all gone in their back at the State House. The General Assembly has, they've all gone in their back rooms with, under the cover of being a Democrat caucus in a restaurant. And they've overcome their petty little differences. And now we can move forward with one of the biggest per capita budgets in the United States. Yay. You know, this ties right in with things I'm inclined to rant about this week, because it all comes down to people not making major decisions on almost no basis over little things, with not even considering the effects on people. I mean, one thing that's really eating at me, and I posted on this earlier today, we're hearing all this stuff about National Grid wants a 53% increase in their energy rates. And that's supposedly terrible, unconscionable, not acceptable. They've got to lower that. The thing of it is, they're prevented by law from making a profit. So this isn't them saying, you know, we want our profit. You know, we could speculate about kickbacks from their suppliers. Who knows? Well, I mean, I'm sure somebody knows, but you know, we could speculate and make conspiracy theories up, and we could also maybe say that because they can't make a profit, they don't have all that much incentive to negotiate down, you know, but then again, they can charge more for distribution. It all comes out in the wash. But the thing you don't hear, I mean, this, by the way, this, despite the fact that fracking is making the United States a lead producer of energy, and it's not that far away if we could just get some pipelines going. So what you don't hear mentioned, and this is what's frustrating, you don't hear the cost of this NIMBYism, not in my backyardism, the cost of preventing pipelines for any little reason, the cost of closing down Brayton coal factory in Somerset, Massachusetts, the cost of fighting the Burrillville plans. You've got renewable energy mandates. You've got multiple, every year, multiple new proposals to make energy more expensive, like a carbon tax, like Representative Regenberg wants to impose, a new tax on fuel brought in by boat. So all these things pile up, and you don't often hear the estimates of costs. Now, it happens that Rhode Island Center for Freedom and Prosperity will be putting out a little bit something in the near future on something related to this. But you would think that would be the biggest thing. So, well, yeah, this is going to cost X, and the cost of climate change is going to be Y. But you don't. I mean, it's just assertions of importance and we need to protect the planet, and carbon is bad and bad. Ew, yucky, gross. It's from oil, which is sticky and icky and toxic. And ew, we've got to fight it. And boy, I like pictures of green things. Look, that company puts a picture of a leaf on its logo. They must be green and friendly and happy. You know, it's like, I don't know if my kids have been watching this Trolls movie a lot, and it's got its moments, but the trolls are all these happy little creatures. And it's, we need to grow up. We need to start thinking of the cost of these things. And when it comes back around and National Grid says, look, we've got to increase our energy rates by 53%, you don't get the politicians, the legislators, the governor, all these people who advocate, the Lieutenant Governor McKee, all these people who advocate for these policies, don't get to then go out and act as if they're the champions of the little people. Hey, it's your fault. You did this. If you think it's justified, if you think your action is justified, own it. Tell people, hey, yes, I was here and I approved those dumb windmills off the coast with their tons of subsidies, and with a guaranteed rate of energy that's now something like four times the cost of natural gas energy. Yeah, I approved of that. So you people, you sit down and you take your 53% increase on your energy. And if you don't like it, you know, get rid of me. I'm the politician. I'm the representative who made this decision. So now, that's how it's supposed to work. But it doesn't work when you've got legislators who won't own their decisions, and when you've got a news media who just doesn't seem to care. These things ought to be in every article about National Grid's increases. What's driving the increase? Oh, gee, could it be all these mandates? Come on, people. The journalists really have to step up and start letting people know where this stuff comes from. And on a related note, also in the upcoming report, is this paid time off, paid sick days, whatever, this mandate from the General Assembly, again originating with Regenberg. Yay, you know, oh, gee, who would have thought you'd get a progressive young representative fresh out of Brown University, the Ivy League, to come and start giving bills out that'll affect our lives. Gee, I wonder if he'll be realistic. But what was striking in looking at this, and by the way, we may have a budget, but we don't know if that means that they're going to come back and pass this paid sick time. This is still one of the variables. It was interesting the other day, I didn't grab the audio from this, but Senate President Dominic Ruggiero was on Gene Valicenti on WPRO, I believe it was, and Gene asked him, well, what bills are you going to take up? And he didn't mention one of the biggest ones, which is this paid sick time. So you could tell he was fishing for, oh, let me see what bills are coming up. Oh, I don't know. Maybe this one and Second Amendment stuff. And yeah, that's about it. A couple little things here and there. He didn't mention paid sick time. So we'll see if it comes through. But in researching this, I didn't find any numbers. I didn't find anybody saying, you know what? This is going to cost our businesses X dollars to require them to give a paid sick time benefit. It's all upside as far as these people are concerned. And, you know, whatever the number is, and it's probably going to be more than you might guess, but it divides up among companies that don't currently offer it. And I think a majority currently do. So a majority of companies offer this. That means the ones who don't have some reason. I mean, maybe it's, you know, we're all imagining, or not we all, but the progressives are all imagining these greedy business owners who are just making their employees come into work like Bob Cratchit and suffer and spread their illness throughout the workplace and lose money and productivity because it's really a stupid greed of these business people who don't see that if they would just let people take off sick, it'll save them money and they'll actually make more money. And no, you've got a minority of companies that don't offer this. You know, maybe there's some legitimate reason, maybe the nature of their business model, the nature of the business, it doesn't much matter whether they offer a sick time. Maybe this is just a competitive advantage they have to have, and the lack of that cost, and the employees are good with that, and they come up with some other way of accommodating them. But no, we don't consider any of that. We just say, you know, this is a good thing for me, Mr. Politician, to promise people to buy their votes. And whatever it costs, it costs. And then, you know, when there's no employment and companies are closing down and people are moving out of the state, which they are and have been doing for years, probably decades, when that's all going on, the politicians go, you know what? Oh, you can't tie that back to me. We're not being progressive enough. If we would only raise the costs on businesses and give more money away, it would all be great. And while we're doing it, we'll plan roadmap Rhode Island, and we'll figure out where everybody has to live, and we'll tell them what kinds of houses they can have, and they have to be walkable and all this stuff, and it will make it really expensive to live here, but that'll drive people out and people won't be able to afford houses. So what we'll do is we'll subsidize the poor people so they'll get affordable housing, and we'll put them in everybody's neighborhood and on and on and on. And we're going down in a hole because people aren't aware enough in government to have a real conversation about what's the cost of this, what's the benefits. Where are our limits as government officials? And if we get rid of those limits, what's the cost of that? You know, if you think these things are worth the case, come out with the cost, come out and make the case. Don't downplay the cost in advance and hide from them when they hit. Go out there. Enough with the stuff of there's no downside to this. It's the only downside is for greedy business owners who want to make their employees suffer. Yeah, come on, give me a break. It's time to stop accepting that from these people. So I guess my theme today, excuse me, is that, you know, humanity isn't really governed by reason. Yeah, a friend of mine has often said he was disappointed in maturing. He had this sort of ideal idea about humanity, and that as technology and wealth freed us up, we'd all be sitting around having reading and having deep discussions. And that, you know, that's just not what's happened at all. So, you know, we're, in a lot of ways, we're not governed by reason. We're governed in large part by superstition and emotion. Being governed by reason takes work. It takes compromise. It takes accepting that other people are just fundamentally have different opinions than us, and we'll defend them. And so we're vulnerable to being manipulated on, based on superstitions and on emotions. It's a small one, and I put it in one of those categories. It's probably easier not to discuss. But in 2015, right here in Tiverton, this made actually state news this week. An English teacher named Christopher Fielding, in 2015, he dragged a student across the floor, about 10 feet or so. So he was fired that year. And the accounts that I've read, and I won't claim to have investigated this and gone to the school committee members and said, give me the details and all this stuff. But from the report, the recent reports, basically it was a joking around thing. The girl was supposed to be going to gym class. She walked into his classroom, disrupting his class, sat down on the floor and refused to move. And he essentially was trying to get her out of there, half jokingly said, "What, do I have to drag you down there?" And she said yes. And so he grabbed her to great hilarity, pulled her a few feet down along the floor. She got up, went to gym class, and you know, that was more or less the end of it. So he was fired. And now the State Department of Education has overruled the firing, which is a terrible thing to do. I mean, you want to talk about who runs a local school. We know now, right? You know, your school committee has very little authority now. When they differ with you just run to a mom and dad at the state. Run to the real authorities, and whether you're a union member or a student or whatever, that's the real authority. You go to them. You don't get to work it out at the local area. So that I completely think is wrong. If the school committee wanted to fire the guy, you know, that's the thing. I guess there could be lawsuits, but that starts to be, then you get into the union issue. And I should note, by the way, if I have the right guy, I'm pretty sure, I don't think there's only one Christopher Fielding who teaches or has taught middle school English in Tiverton. But in 2007, he was actually suspended or something like that for publishing some kind of letter to the editor or something in a union newsletter. So against the school committee members. And, you know, so I'm not ideologically aligned with this guy, especially if he's big into the local union. But if you look at the facts of this case as they've been presented and how everybody involved took it, you know, is this a firing offense? Can't we kind of admit that, you know, teachers deal with kids, sometimes difficult kids, sometimes good kids, putting them in difficult situations every day, all day, for 180 days a year? And we can debate how significant that is as a work year, but that, putting that aside, you know, sometimes people, even if you insist on seeing this as a lapse in judgment, which I suppose in retrospect you must do given the consequences, then, you know, can't we say, all right, you had 10 second lapse of judgment in 180 day work year, you're fired? Seems a bit egregious to me. And it seems like our emotions and our sort of shibboleths and superstitions kind of running away with us. I mean, we get this sort of like moral spotlight, and we focus on, in this case, the vulnerability of the female student. And we cease to see the teacher as somebody who's in there trying to deal with their own issues as a professional and as a human being too. And we react to the details with some imagined worst case almost. I mean, even when I said it, it occurred to me, even as I said it, introducing this segment, he dragged her across the floor. It sounds so violent and terrible, but I haven't seen any indication of that. It could have been lightly pulling her across the floor. If it had been another student, it would have been, you know, well, who knows these days, but certainly when I was in high school, that sort of thing would have just been laughed off, and a teacher would say, hey, cut it out, and there you go, you're done. You know, not a, especially if everybody was laughing and it were was a friendly interaction. So we imagine, I think, this, oh, dragged her across the floor. Well, that's got to be wrong. Well, how wrong? I mean, we're not talking like it doesn't appear that he, you know, pulled her with such force that she flew backwards and hit her head on a chair. And it's the same as if, like, our response to that's hypothetical business owner who's abusing his or her employees. You know, we ignore all these businesses that might have excellent reasons for not offering paid sick times. It might have been an agreement between, in a sense, a negotiated agreement between the employer and the employees. That might be the best thing. For all we know, there are businesses in Rhode Island where the business owner said, I want to do this for you. I want to give you paid sick time, but I'm going to have to do this or that with salaries or whatever. And the employee said, no, don't give us paid sick time. That may have happened. We don't know. There was no investigation. And the General Assembly, they expect that when they proclaim that they're going to do these things, people who are interested are just going to come running forward and go, hey, you know what? I pay very careful attention to what laws you all might pass every year and run up here and take time out of my day so that I can testify. No, that doesn't happen. The activists testify. Maybe if something gets enough of a momentum then and enough attention, then people will come out of the woodwork. But most people, they just want to go on with their lives, and they shouldn't have to be watching over their backs that their own representatives are going to come after them and interfere with their lives and their businesses. But we focus on that business, that imagined business, the worst case. What could this? It's just wrong that these people, this could happen. That theoretically, a greedy business owner could force a starving family's caretaker to be at work and spread the flu in a sweatshop, shoulder to shoulder with other employees. I mean, that's what we imagine. And if that exists in Rhode Island, that's not the typical case of, I guarantee it, of these companies that aren't offering it. And most likely, so you force this issue on this imagined scenario, and you end up with fewer people working and cut pay. Another one, this may be a podcast to get me in trouble, but another issue I raised earlier this week on OceanStateCurrent.com that has some of the same warnings is this idea of Rhode Island just passed a new mandate for health insurance. So all health insurance has to cover, I think it's called fertility preservation treatments, where they freeze eggs or sperm. In our sites, and the picture taken in the headline sort of story is cancer patients who undergo chemotherapy. And I mean, it's a terrible thing. And so as one more thing to ease that and protect their futures, they're allowed to, they get this treatment to preserve their fertility in case the treatment for cancer leaves them sterile. And that's certainly a scenario for which we can have a lot of sympathy. And my understanding is that actually most insurance already covers this in Rhode Island. So again, we're dealing with the General Assembly picking a story and saying, well, that can't happen, and therefore nobody should have an option to not get this coverage. Never mind if you are already sterile. Never mind if you never plan to have kids or already have kids or beyond the age of being able to have kids. You have to have this coverage now. This has to be built into your insurance so you can pay for this sympathetic story. So now, the controversial aspect, though, beyond just, well, it's not controversial for the state to force people to buy insurance anymore, I guess. But the really controversial issue, or at least what the journalists are presenting as controversial, is that this may prove to have to cover transgenders. So transgendered people. So if a man wants to preserve his ability to father children after he becomes sterile because he tried to make his body more like that of a woman, the insurance has to cover that procedure. And I juxtaposed this with a story out of, it's from the United Kingdom, The Telegraph, last year, where the National Health Service was warning obese people and smokers that they were going or likely to be denied operations, even things like knee surgery, that were just a consequence of their health decisions, their eating habits, and which could be, you know, they could have a predisposition to that. I mean, if we're being honest. So you put these two things together, and as I argued on OceanStateCurrent.com, you put together this idea that the government health and health care in England is telling fat people they will not, let alone not receiving insurance coverage or mandated insurance coverage, they will not receive treatment for the consequences of their lifestyles. Whether that's a predisposition or what, I didn't see any distinction in the story between that. An exception, if you can prove that you just can't stop yourself from eating or your metabolism just makes it impossible for you to lose weight. That wasn't an exception that I saw in a story. So the government's saying that, and at the same time, you've got Rhode Island, it seems, saying, you know what, if you think you're the other sex from which you were born and you are going to undergo surgery to change your body, you know what, the insurance is going to have to cover your attempt to mitigate the circumstances in your fertility. Your fertility, by the way, as the gender you say you're not. But so you got these things. And, you know, we could argue about the insanity of our culture and about whether where the moral obligation lies as a separate matter from whether government should mandate the insurance. We can argue about whether the government should mandate this kind of insurance anyway. But to me, and the thing I emphasized in my article, the key point here is that these are health decisions ultimately, and this is undeniable, ultimately being made on the basis of political fashion. Right now, transgenderism is a thing that people are paying a lot of attention to. All the virtue signaling is going crazy. You're not allowed to say certain things or think some certain things. And so government steps in, the politicians step in to capitalize on this tide of virtue signaling and put out legislation like this. And then being heavy and being fat is not to the liking of our cultural elites, because, you know, it's a Walmart thing, right? It's a McDonald's Walmart thing. It's the working and lower classes that get fat and eat fatty foods and drink soda, and you don't they even know there's arugula. And you can easily imagine, though, and here's the key point, I don't know that I got into it enough in my post, but you can imagine, say, some sort of famine or some circumstance in the world that makes weight, food more expensive or whatever. And so being overweight, again, like it used to be in history, becomes a sign of wealth, of thriving, is you're so wealthy that you can afford to be fat, rather than poverty, which in some ways it is now, or not destitute poverty, but, you know, lower class, kind of low income, that level of poverty. If we accept that healthcare decisions are made at the state house, whether mandating or forbidding coverage, then the governing elites can flip. They'll just go from one to the other. So right now, transgenderism is fashionable, so the elites want to eliminate the consequences. But it could just as easily become a preference to eliminate the consequences of overeating, so that will flip. And then it'll be the consequences of poverty that won't receive health care, whereas the consequences of the excesses of the elites will. This is a dangerous position to be in. And especially because we have, as I said, we're losing perspective. Last week's Sakonnet Times, not to go all, you know, all local, but I found it so striking. And it took me a week to kind of, I had to go find the paper again. I thought it was in a different paper because it had just struck me weird. But the cover, front page, top story, above the fold, it's an unattributed article, headline, "Cruelty, Never Forget." Now, "Never Forget" has a very specific connotation in our society. I mean, it has a long history. I mean, it's a useful phrase. Never forget. We will never forget. They will never forget. This will never be forgotten. It's in, for example, the Gettysburg Address. History will never forget. Well, history will forget the words we say here, but it will never forget what they did here. And obviously that's probably backwards from the truth. But where it really got its modern connotation was in the Holocaust. And now never forget has been for a while what we say about human atrocities to other humans. That's the Holocaust. This is killing millions of people in some way or other, whether it applies, you know, whether I've seen it applied to Armenia, for example, the genocide. But it's this is what never forget means. What was the article in the Sakonnet Times? Let me read you the first two paragraphs. Frightful as what they saw down that debris-lined lane into the woods and beyond the gate, those who saw the animal abuse horrors firsthand say they are now buoyed by other memories. At a wet but uplifting day of remembrance outside Westport Town Hall Monday evening, 1 year to the day after the second cruelty episode was revealed off American Legion Highway, speakers told of what it meant to see people from close to home and far and wide spend months helping the survivors among the 1,400 victims. And then a little bit farther down in the article, Wendy Taylor, owner of West Place Animal Sanctuary in Tiverton, told of the arrival of dozens of refugees from Westport, mostly birds and even fish at first. Later, some large farm animals, including sheep. So this is an animal abuse story. Headline, never forget. I mean, animal abuse is bad. Helping living things is good. We should value life. And especially, you know, as an impulse, we should encourage other people. It should be seen as a sign of being a good person to value life in human beings, in animals. We're at risk, though, of losing perspective. I mean, largely, again, because we're not really thinking through the whys and wherefores of this all. I was listening, catching up on my econ talk. Again, econ talk. What's with you in this econ talk? But I was listening to econ talk. It's a podcast, Russ Roberts, Hoover Institution. And he had on as his guest, I think her name is pronounced Tamar Haspel. And they were having an excellent discussion about some of the economics around farming, and she's an oyster, has an oyster farm, so and writes on other farming and food issues. And they were having an excellent discussion on the benefits and costs of food production methods, and it touched on this idea of animal cruelty. And so here, take a listen to this clip.
We have developed chickens, bred chickens, that are really, really good egg layers, not just really good at laying eggs, but really good at doing it on less feed. So we have some breeds of chickens that are just astonishing. And I have egg laying chickens in my backyard, and I'm astonished at even how they can convert feed into eggs.
What are your chickens in your backyard? What do they, how often do they lay?
Well, it depends. In their heyday, they lay probably about 250 to 300 eggs a year.
Yeah.
But as they get old, it decreases significantly.
Yeah. A modern industrial chicken lays about an egg a day, closer to 350, I think.
That phrase struck me, the industrial chicken, you know, like the industrial vacuum cleaner. You know, You hear about, you know, well, if you think of a fable, you know, there was personification, whereas you humanize something, an animal, could be a rock or whatever, but you personify, make an animal seem like a person. And this is more like, you know, the opposite, the depersonification or the de-animification or maybe the thingification. I like that. But they go on to discuss the, you know, like what the, how chicken cages and how they're restrictive. And this is something we've had legislation on in Rhode Island in the recent past as well. Big fights over chicken cage size and, you know, what the life of a chicken ought to look like and where the boundaries are. But seems to me. I mean, we can talk about, I think, to me, the life of a chicken is running free, cage free. Okay, well, what about this size cage? Where's the trade-off on the life of the chicken's freedom versus the ability to, as Russ Roberts points out, for two people to operate $1 million chicken coop, a million chicken coop. That's how efficient it is as far as human labor. So if you can restrict their movement and that sort of thing. So where's the balance here? And they talk about that as a practical matter, but they never quite, and it seems we never get quite to the questions that are really keep it from just being a sort of unresolvable superstition. We have to know why it's bad to treat chickens this way, to prevent them from living a chickenly life. I mean, if they've been bred to be industrial chickens, on what grounds do we determine that this isn't their ideal chickenly life? I mean, they've been bred this way. Do they have some sense of the wild heritage of running free in a forest? I don't know, maybe, but we have to ask these questions. And I mean, is it what makes this bad? What makes it good to oppose this? Is it the effect that cruelty has on humans that I could see? We would, you know, you want people to value life. And so that's what is of concern, is that if we don't value these chickens, then we'll transfer that. We'll be the kind of people who don't value life, and that'll transfer. Or is it the danger of devaluing the life of animals? And in that case, if we devalue the life of animals, we'll devalue the lives of human beings. Is that the concern? Or if there are innate rights that animals hold, what are they? And where do they come from? On what grounds do they have rights? I'm not convinced, and this is really to the hub of the matter, I guess. I'm not convinced that people these days understand why human beings have innate rights. What's the foundation of that? Well, because we say we like it that way. Well, that's something that can flip. That's something that can change under various circumstances. And so obviously we can't explain why human beings have rights. How are we going to explain what rights animals have, where they derive from? I mean, I've been giving this sort of thing a lot of thought on theological grounds. You know, what constitutes a soul? And if I have a soul by some measure and a chicken doesn't, how much concern ought there to be about the chicken? I haven't come to an answer. These are questions we should spend more time addressing, especially if we have free time, which I actually don't, but we have to be able to answer these questions at some level of culture and society. Otherwise, when the ethos or the fashion of the times changes, we'll see our new principles, we'll have compromised our principles, and we'll see those principles apply in a different way. So the danger here is that when you start to elevate animals to the status of people, that you've got front page news articles as if animal cruelty in Westport is like the Holocaust. Never forget. I mean, how is that not diluting the Holocaust? So you're elevating the animals to status like people. So if you accept that without a foundation for why you're doing that elevation and an understood foundation, then if down the road the fashion changes and the ethos of the times changes and we start to question why animals deserve rights, like that, then, and that could happen if there's a famine, right? Suddenly we won't have that leeway to make food more expensive for emotional reasons. But then that'll flip. And if we've already accepted that animals have rights like people, but we don't know why either has rights, and we at some point decide that animals don't have those sorts of rights, we might just decide that people don't have any more rights than animals. This is very dangerous territory. I mean, man, I guess at the beginning of this, I might have been a little hard on legislators and government officials, telling them to, you know, be adults and address things like adults. I don't know that we can expect that from elected officials if we can't expect it from ourselves. We need to up our game, people. and understand why we take the positions we do. And it can't just be emotion. It can't be superstition. It can definitely take a lot of advisement from philosophy, and especially I would say religion. These are important things, but we have to understand where they're coming from and why we're applying them as we are. Because otherwise, we're just lashing around like a fire hose that nobody's holding on to. And oh man, it's easy to get hit in the head, even with the best of intentions.